Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, 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 this is Jimmy Carboni of Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Today is Tuesday, October 6th, and we've been talking about the Beer Bible book with Jeff Alworth. How are you, man? Welcome to the show. Well, Jeff, one reason you're on the show is you got a great book out, and I'm really enjoying it, the Beer Bible. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in that project. I know there was one book called The Wine Bible, and just tell us about the process of writing that book, and then we'll talk about some of the beers you mentioned in the book.
Cool. Yeah, you're right. It came, Workman Publishing is the publisher, and they're the ones.
And then Maggie's going to bring us that special beer we've been waiting for.
Okay, cool. Right. Workman Publishing is the publisher, and they're the ones who had the idea. They were looking for somebody to write it, and there was a kind of a long process of trying to find the person, and I got to be that person, and you know, I wrote this very long book. So that's what it is.
It is a long book. I mean, our friend Josh Bernstein has his complete beer course that has been doing very well.
Absolutely. Josh knows a lot about beer.
So how is it, so now you get someone to compare yourself again. How is your book different than his?
We all compare ourselves to Josh. I think this is a little bit, it's designed to be kind of an encyclopedia of beer. And I was really aiming to make it possible for people who'd never really gotten into beer to have some resource, but also people who are really into beer, who knew a lot about beer, would have a resource. So I was really trying to aim it at all levels. So each chapter it starts out at the history and goes into some basic stuff, and then it evolves into the brewing notes, and I talk to brewers, and you know, we get into things like mash temperatures and stuff that basic people are not going to be that interested in. So I'm trying to hit all those things. So it's really a resource. You dip into it. It's not a kind of book like Josh's where you read it and you know everything about beer. It's a little bit different than that.
Yeah. No, I liked it. I kind of like your writing style, and I also like how deep you went. And you started out with every beer tells a story.
Yeah.
That was pretty interesting. And we're going to drink a flagship from Staten Island, New York, mild, because it's like kind of an English style. And you were talking about things like the bitter style.
Right.
Let's go into that chapter of your book and talk about English beer.
Yeah.
From your perspective, and Stephen and Ed will join in.
Yeah, English beer is great. I had cheers to everybody. Thanks for having me to Brooklyn. It's great.
Live at Heritage Radio Network.
Yeah, we're live.
The Birders in Bushwick.
We're all waving our glasses around trying to clink them. England was the first country I went to, and it was, I always thought that, I kind of understood English beer. Our tradition sort of comes from English brewing, the American tradition. And I didn't really understand English beer, and it was cool to go there. And English beer is best experienced in the pub. You know, when you make English beer, you're making it to be drunk in the pub. You're not making it for people to go out, you know, and buy a six-pack and drink in the backyard. People drink it, they drink a lot of beers. They go to the pub, and they want to have 5, 6, 7 pints of beer. So it's got to be a beer both that you won't destroy you over that period of that session, but also that is interesting through the whole time. It won't destroy your palate, but it'll keep it interested and enlivened. So that's kind of the nature of English beer. And actually, when I was writing the mild chapter, that's what came to me, because mild is the one style from English brewing that never really got a following elsewhere. It's just an English style. So I was wondering, you know, what makes mild, you know, why does mild exist? Why am I even writing about it? And it was really, I had to go to the pub in England and see people drinking to get mild and get why this beer exists.
Well, this culture beer, out there too, I think.
It's culture, right? But what this beer is, what? So it's mild, it's got color.
Yeah.
And Stephen, have you ever made a recipe for mild? Or English bitters or anything?
Yeah, certainly. And we did a recipe in our last book from Ron Pattinson, the beer historian, and it was a 1945 mild, so like recreating an old English mild as well.
Flagship really hit it on the nose with this one too. I really like this beer, and it was one of my favorites from their brewery.
How do we know how strong this beer is?
I'd say 5%.
Five and change.
So it's a little bit of a strong mild.
Yeah. But it's like a lot of American pale ales. You know, they're 5%, right? Not 4%.
It's got a lot.
Do you carry Flagship at Mug's Ale House?
I actually don't because I'm, after 23 years this Friday, I have become so confused in what to pour these things. It's just too much. But I don't, I've had, I think maybe I've poured it once, I think, you know, but I should. But
like I know, you had a lot of the American pioneers of craft beer. Like, you still have like Anchor Steam on. And
yeah, I think I'm one of the few last guys that poured some of the, well, we always poured, we used to pour from, we poured Sierra Nevada Pale Ale for 22 years. We poured Anchor Liberty to this day, which is 23 years. We are probably one of the craft beer bars in New York that still kind of, you know, tip our hats to the old guys. And I guess now I'm an old guy, so I guess it falls into but the
they're
whole.
Not they're not coming in ordering pints of mild and bitter.
You know, I'll tell you, you know, you mentioned English. And years ago, I remember when we started out, Fuller's ESB was one, probably still to this day, I think one of the best English bitters. I think that's a bitter, right? If I'm not mistaken.
It's an exceptional beer. Yeah.
Right. But it's phenomenal. I could never drink it. But we used to sell it a lot. And then, like, the whole English style, I mean, I guess because American brewing took off and it just kind of, you know, we've got our own now. We don't need anybody else type of attitude. So all our craft beers have taken off. And you know, that's great. It's a great thing. It's just that for somebody like me, it's become chaos.
Yeah, that's right. People... You know. I keep hearing that the brewers say that drinkers are promiscuous. They're not loyal anymore. They're promiscuous. So they always want something new.
Let's talk about the size because this is interesting. So this is a mild. So it's dark. It's an ale. You know, how did the mild come about? Isn't there's the bitter, extra special bitter. Tell us more. Let's go more into like English pubs and English drinking.
It is an old style. So the word mild dates back to a time long before this style existed, in which it referred to all beers in England were either mild or stale, which is to say that they were either fresh, they were served, they hadn't been, you know, they weren't in, they would brew it and they would serve it in the pubs immediately. It was fresh, so it was still carbonated, still had it hadn't been barrel aged, which meant it hadn't gotten Brettanomyces in it, so it was still sweet. And it could be any style of beer. It could have been low alcohol, high alcohol, pale, dark, whatever, mild. That's what a mild was. And then over the course of time, it evolved, and as the centuries rolled by, it became more and more associated with a darker beer. People started calling these milds darker, the darker beers, they called them mild, although you can still get pale milds in England. And we had the great gravity drops. So this is one thing that really shapes beer styles that we don't think about. It's things like famine, war, tax law, all these kinds of things really can shape the way brewers make beers. And in the world that we had the two world wars, and in both cases in the UK, it forced brewers to brew really low alcohol beers. And eventually that's how the palate emerged. People went away from strong beers and went to light beers. And following World War II, when England was trying to rebuild the country, it was a working man's drink, mild. It was like a 3.5% beer. You could afford it. And people had developed the flavor for mild low alcohol beers, so that's where the style kind of emerged.
That was a chapter I was on in your book that I really liked. Every beer tells a story, and you're going there. So you talk about that 1936 Coronation Ale,
right?
So you know,
yeah. So this is a great story. I'm an American. I don't know anything about coronation, but apparently every time a king gets or queen gets coronated, all the breweries make special beers for that. Yep. And it's been a very long time since this happened, since we've had Queen Elizabeth in there forever. But in 1936, there was a guy who was going to come on, and they made all these breweries made beers to coronate this king. But it was the guy who abdicated the throne so he could marry an American. And they all had beers sitting around that they couldn't sell because he didn't become the king. and then Green King put a few of them, a bunch of them in their vast cellars and just left them there. And then people found them recently, and we discovered those. So it was kind of like a time capsule.
Did you have some, Matt?
Yeah, I drank a 1901 Bass King's Ale.
There you go.
Actually, it was a very interesting experience.
Yeah, drinking these historical beers are great because you can see this is actually like we read about what beers were like 100 years ago, but you taste them and you can see actually this is how they were made, the malts, like all that stuff.
I mean, for a 100-year-old beer, it was incredible just to see it first off, and you know, the wax intact and everything, and it was an interesting experience. I mean, you know, of course, you know, they all turn into sherry after a while. But you know, I didn't get sick and I didn't drop dead, so I was happy about that.
And they actually taste better than you would expect. That's what I
discovered. A hell of a lot more. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's not.
Yes,
you expect them to be gasoline or something terrible, and it's
right. No, we finished them.
Right.
We finished them. It was definitely an experience at Mugs. We had Jimmy Anderson. Were you around for Jim Anderson? I don't know, but from Philly. But he was another beer guru out here. He's out at the Anderson in Scotland now. And Bill Coleman and a couple of beer geeks that made this experience an experience. It was actually called, we dubbed it the Casey Stengel.
Maybe we should go over to Mugs after this.
We can go roam around my cellar.
You're not the oldest guy in the beer world, Ed, but your place is one of the stalwarts.
I'm not.
If you've got more 100-year-old beers, I'm definitely into that.
I don't have any hundreds. The youngest beer that we had was the first Thomas Hardy's. So that was 1960, I think it's 3 or 8 or something like that. It was the youngest one. Then they went back.
Right. And those are built for aging. So those were probably fine. Those were probably really tasty.
We had Ballantine IPAs from 1955. And then we had, I forgot the whole list. There's an article out there somewhere online from Wine Spectator, because there was no beer advocate or anything back then. So.
Wow.
It was interesting.
That's definitely very cool.
You're the old guy. Yeah.
Told you.
So, Jeff, you traveled.
Of course, I get
thrown
out of my
seat. This book, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
What were some of the places that you really liked visiting that you hadn't been to?
So, I went. The book was a 2-year project. So, I did ales first. I went to UK, to the Bière de Garde region of France, and then to Belgium, and then I went back. Actually, when I was in Belgium, all the Belgian brewers said, "Are you going to Italy? You should go to Italy." And Italy was not on my map. So enough Belgian brewers ask you to go to Italy, then, you know, you figure you better go to Italy. So when I went back, I did mostly lagers, but then I hit Italy at the end. So I did Germany, Czech Republic, and Italy. And, you know, it was really cool. I got to make a list of all the best breweries I wanted to go to and contact them and just see if they would host me. And basically, most of them did. There were a few that didn't, and it wasn't because they rejected me. It's just because I couldn't get in touch with them in time, or the timing didn't work out. But you know, it was like a who's who of the best breweries. If you name a country, you know, it was like everyone, just the ones you want to go to.
How long did it take? The whole
research. It was about 7 weeks altogether, so about 3.5 weeks both times. I was charging through countries. It was kind of brutal. There were times when I was doing 2 breweries in a day, and it sounds great, except, you know, you'd much rather just hang out with a brewer all day long and not have to get on the road and go to the next brewer.
Yeah.
So those times when I had to cut it short were pretty painful. Fortunately, I didn't have to do that too much.
So what were some of the breweries that you featured in your book?
So in the book, one thing that I hadn't planned to do, but then I decided to do once I started visiting these breweries, is I would visit a brewery and realize that it was really described a particular style. So like Urge in Dusseldorf is perfectly characteristic of alt beer, and DuPont is perfectly characteristic of Saison, and Fuller's is perfectly characteristic of cask ales. So I was realizing that I should write little chapters about these guys and describe why they perfectly characterize that style of brewing. And I think there's 18 of those in the
that's,
book.
That's one thing I really liked about the book.
Yeah, I think it's worth, you talked about stories earlier. One way to understand stories is to understand, you know, to encounter the brewery, talk to a brewer, understand how their style of beer evolved in their brewery, and it becomes kind of a narrative. And then actually that's how I got to understand these beers. So I thought it would be a good way to describe how these beers emerged, and it would, you know, explain it to other people too.
That's awesome. We're off to a great start here. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
I tripped, I was in the surfing band. Why you tear me on my open door?
In
1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's October, and we're hanging out, and we've got Jeff, the author of The Beer Bible, which is pretty great. And Stephen, what were you asking him about DuPont?
Yeah, I was curious. Because
places he's traveled, he's been all over the world researching the book.
Yeah, he mentioned DuPont, and I know they kind of notoriously don't give many interviews, because I know last one of the times they did, someone stole their yeast. So, and you said you did speak to them, so I was wondering how you kind of thought, how you found interviewing European brewers as a whole, and then kind of how that came to be.
Yeah, tell us about going to was it Domaine DuPont? So someone,
yeah, tell us.
Brewery DuPont.
Brasserie DuPont. One thing that I learned was a great way to get in touch with people, just ask the logistic question, is talk to an importer, because the importers have good connections. So that was one way I set that up, because if you try to cold call these breweries, you're random American. They're not going to talk to you. So it was nice to go through importers. But yeah, it's true that there were a few. I got to go to Samuel Smith's in England, and very few people have toured that brewery. And DuPont, you're right, very people have toured that brewery, I think, for different reasons. I think the reason Samuel Smith is extremely tight-fisted about information, so they don't like people knowing what's going on. DuPont is different. Olivier Dedecker is the main brewer there now, and one of the 10 family owners who's owned it. I think the brewery was founded in the 1850s. He's just a really shy guy, and I think he's not one of these gregarious kind of brewers that you sometimes find. So I think he doesn't like to give tours. He was a very, very quiet guy, and I had my little audio recorder, and sometimes I had to really stick it right in front of him just to even be able to hear what he was saying, because he just, it just is a little tiny family
brewery. So tell us about the DuPont brewery. I've always been fascinated. I know that his importers years ago said that they saved the Saison DuPont.
They did, yeah.
Importing him.
He was selling a lot more Radore pills, which was the pills they were making. They sell that locally. And then in the country, they were selling Moinette, which is like a triple style. And the Saison, which is the old holdout brewery from, or the whole style from way back, was dying off. And then Wendy Littlefield and Don Feinstein of Van Bergen & Wolf went there, and they said, this is spectacular. And with Michael Jackson, they all were like, this is the best beer ever. You should continue to brew this. And they helped him find a market in the United States to keep it going. But when they found that brewery, it was extraordinary. They were still malting their own grain. It was totally a farmhouse brewery. It was completely, basically unchanged from the 19th century. Mm-hmm. All their equipment dated to the 19th century. Their mash tun dated to the 1850s, which is shocking. By the time I visited, it had completely given out, and they'd had to replace it. They do, their kettle is fired with a open flame, which is kind of rare, and that gives it they only use, for Saison DuPont, they only use Pilsner malt, and if you ever have that beer, you'll realize it's very orange, and it's because they do a long boil and let it, the Maillard reactions create that orange quality. But the most amazing thing, the thing I think you were alluding to, is the yeast. And I really wanted to see, is this yeast as crazy as I think it is? And it was cool to go to the fermenters and see the temperature readings that they had, because this is a famous yeast strain that performs well in the 90s. And up to like blood temperature, like 98, 99, 100 degrees. And Yeah, I went there, and I could see the readouts, and they were like 35 degrees Celsius, 34 degrees Celsius. They were just extremely hot, and it blew my mind. I took a photo of that and put it. It's actually, I think it's in the book. Nobody will appreciate it, but it's just no other brewers want to brew that warm. Even people who use that yeast in America are scared to death to brew at 98 degrees. That's just like fermenting at 98 degrees is crazy.
That's why we always tell people to brew saisons in New York summers.
Right. And yeah, it's what I do too.
You'll have a great beer.
Yeah, you want to let it get as hot as possible, especially because when you're home brewing, you don't get the same kind of kinetic stuff, so it won't rise as much as a professional brewer. So you need it to be hot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and mostly home brewers don't have jackets to warm their beer up. So yeah, you got to let the ambient.
If people really well, this more about the brewery. So today, it still has all the historical, equipment.
Yeah, it does. I mean, they had to replace the mash tun, but they replaced it in the way that it looks. It's the same. They just bought a new one that looks exactly like the old one. The kettle is still quite old. The fermenters they use. Another interesting thing about the fermenters, they use horizontal fermenters that are square, and I think that has something to do with the action of the yeast, because square doesn't it doesn't convect as well. And when you have a cylindroconical, as people have seen in the United States, very tall, there's a lot of diastatic pressure that pushes down on the yeast, and it makes it behave differently. When it's flat, it does different stuff. And then one of the most interesting things about DuPont is when they go through the bottling line, they do a bottle fermentation. In Belgium, one of the most important features of Belgian brewing is all beer goes through a secondary fermentation in the bottles. They put a little wort and a little bit of yeast back in the bottle so that they get even more of that ester formation that it characterizes Belgian brewing. DuPont has discovered that if the bottle is upright when it comes off the bottling line and they do the secondary fermentation upright, the flavor is not appropriate. So they have they hire people at the end of the bottling line to take those bottles and lay them down in crates that will then go to the bottling line, so that the secondary fermentation will function better when the bottle is laid on its side rather than standing straight up.
So recreating a open fermenter.
It's sort of in a bottle. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And actually, when I was there, and I assume this has now changed, he said that they were going to buy a robot. They had purchased a robot that will actually do that and lay the bottles down. So modern. That's how modern.
It's nice. This is our. So we talked about milds, and then maybe we'll talk about bitters. We're talking about saisons. It's nice to talk about European beers. It's so many people are focused on IPAs and American craft beer, but I think there's such great history.
Yeah, I think it's like a little bit like vocabulary, right? It's good if you know the grammar, and then you can riff on it. Americans always riff on things, so we make cucumber gozes, we make IPAs with really strong IPAs, IPAs with American hops. Like we always tinker with stuff. We make hoppy alts. We do whatever, that's what Americans do. But it's good to know what the original styles were like. It's good to know what a Dusseldorfer alt is, so that when you taste an American alt, you can see what the American is doing, and then you appreciate it. It's many times the brewers themselves know what they're doing, so that they would like you to appreciate that. So it's good to know the traditional styles. Well,
another great style you profiled in your book is Trappist beers, or Trappist versus Abbey. And I know we just grabbed from Roberta's this Trappist beer. Let's pour that, Steve, you want to introduce the beer for us?
Sure.
The Austrian Trappist beer.
Yeah, so as everyone knows, most Trappist beers are in Belgium. This one, however, is in Austria, which makes it in many ways unique, but it's a Gregorius, and it's a Trappist.
I think it's from Engelzell. Is that the brewery?
Yeah, from Engelzell. Yeah.
So it's another Trappist brewery, and you did have a nice little section on Trappist versus Abbey styles. Let's talk about that.
Yeah,
Trappist versus Abbey and the history of these great Belgian style beers.
I did mention this one too. They added it. There's an international committee that declares a thing a Trappist or not. And when I was writing the book, they declared this a Trappist, so I had to go back and taste these beers and talk about it. But I didn't actually visit this brewery. The big thing is, in order to be called an Abbey style beer is kind of a general category which could be made anywhere. But if it's a genuine Trappist product, that means that it was brewed on the grounds of a Trappist abbey. It has to be inside the grounds. It can't be brewed for the abbey somewhere else. It can't be contract brewed. It does not mean that it's brewed necessarily by monks, and in some cases they're not. I visited Orval, and the monks don't brew that. It's a commercial production, but it is on the abbey. You got to go in the abbey to do that, to see Orval. So that's really the kind of definition of Trappist, is on the abbey. And in every case that I know of, those proceeds go to support the abbey, when this is a thing that goes all the way back to the 6th century, when the rule of Saint Benedict came down, and the Pope declared that the abbeys had to be self-sustaining. So that was one of the things that they did. Was they?
Who knows the names of all the Trappist breweries? Well, definitely the Belgian ones. I know you knew, Ed.
I used to.
Chimay is an easy one.
Of course.
It's Roquefort, Westmalle.
Yeah, Roquefort. Americans call it Roquefort.
I visited that brewery. They call it Rochefort there. So there you go. But we're Americans. We can call it whatever
it's
we want.
It's funny. I remember somebody's going to be.
I think Maggie's going to tweet out all the Trappist breweries.
Yeah, so then there's also West.
We should know this.
There's West
we
Vletteren.
We should know this.
That's guys. What we got. We got
West Vletteren.
West Vletteren, Orval, Westmalle, Chimay, Ockel.
Ockel. Orval.
Orval. Did I say Orval?
And then in Netherlands, there's La Trappe.
And La Trappe, right? And just across the board.
Now in Austria, it's Engelzell.
Engelzell. And there's one in
Massachusetts. Now.
Yeah. So, and I didn't write about that one.
Which no one knows the name of it.
Yeah.
We're all, and
someone tweet us.
I guess
has anyone been there?
Marketing.
Yeah. We got to go up to Massachusetts and try that.
I'd really like to try that beer. That's another thing. You can't get that beer.
I want to say it's St. Timothy's, but I know that's not true.
It's like that. It's like, yeah, it's like a name. It's like a regular name.
St. Jimmy's.
I bet if you go to @beer_sessions, they will be tweeting the name of the Massachusetts Trappist Brewery.
Right.
But Trappists are cool. Like, I know even, like, there's a lot of other Trappist monasteries. I know that in Montreal there's a Trappist monastery that just makes cheese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I've
so
had
that's,
that.
They make things like cheese and jam, and then sometimes wine and beer, and they got to support themselves. So that's
Jimmy. I was wondering why you're wearing that monk outfit today.
Well, we're in the basement of the old Burb Castle. So talking about 23 anniversaries.
Go, right.
Back when you started Mug's Ale House, there was this thriving place on East 7th Street called Burb Castle.
Exactly.
And the staff really did dress in monk's robes. Have you ever been there, Jeff?
Is it still there?
No, it's still there. It's my upstairs neighbor.
Do they still dress up and do the whole spiel?
They kind of stopped doing that, but some enthusiasts will do it.
I used to go there.
There's one woman that's an opera singer, and she'll still wear the robe. So I think she's on Saturday nights at Burb Castle.
They have the murals on the walls still?
They haven't taken that away. They're like the murals of the intoxicated monks.
So like,
it's
like being a bar owner for 23 years, you had like an expression on your face when we mentioned drinkers being fickle. Perhaps like they're looking for the new beer all the time, but do you feel that they're loyal to where they drink it?
Yeah, I think so. I have to say we have a good percentage of regulars that do come back and know. But I attribute that to the fact that we do have like a standard set of beers that people that do want to just have that can come and have that. And then we rotate the other ones. And if we have something interesting, then they will explore.
That's a good point. And it's good to have Jeff here. It's because for us, so many of the good beer bars are like always rotating.
Right.
But then you realize that for a customer, so the difference between the on the edge beer bar with all rotating taps versus that customer who had a really good beer and wants to come back and have the same one. And that's how question, how do you deal with it? I know how you've dealt with it by keeping some of your classics. But how do you think that plays into because I change my beers all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I can talk mainly as a drinker here, and I'm interested actually in your insight. I like to go back and forth. As a guy who writes about beer, I do feel like I need to keep abreast of the new beers that are coming out, and especially if a beer is highly touted. When I was just drinking beer this afternoon, and I wanted to drink local beers here, make sure I was getting a sense of what's going on here. But I like to go back and forth. There are beers that I absolutely love, and it's terrible if all you ever do is drink the new thing. You end up going through a lot of beers you don't like. You end up,
Right, exactly.
You want to go back to your faves, and I have... I don't know, probably 20 beers that I love, absolutely love, and every time I see them on a list, I want to drink one of those beers. So, and I go back and forth. That's how I handle as a drinker. I don't know how you guys do it, but
I mean, I know when I go to Jimmy's, I'm going to get something different from New York, basically, or for the most part. But then you have breweries like Transmitter here in Long Island City, and they basically don't make the same beer more than once. Mm-hmm.
Well, we've been pouring them. Actually, I love what they did. I think it was very smart on their hand, and I think they did a great job. And their beers are phenomenal for a local brewery to do that and those styles.
But Ed, you know. So how do you pick your list? Because you have over 20 taps at Mugs.
God, it used to be easier. I mean, we have 32, and it used to be a lot easier, but it's a lot more difficult. I keep telling it. I've had this conversation with hundreds of people in the last couple of months. It's gone psychotic in New York. I mean, I remember way back in the 90s when there was no beer to pour. I mean, Rogue was in New Jersey, and I was like going to swim over to New Jersey to pick up a barrel of Rogue to bring it back to pour in New York because it was unbelievable. But now, I don't know. I mean, I used to be able to try beers. I can't try all the beers anymore. I mean, I'm 50. That's one thing. It doesn't work anymore. But I kind of go on the whim. I'm trying to create alliances with breweries. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to do this attitude like I scratch your back, you scratch mine. I'll keep pouring you. You get anything special, small batch, send it my way. And that's what I'm trying to do, and I'll guarantee them a line.
I'll tell you what, we're taking a break, but think about which breweries in New York City you want to work with to make Mugs Ale House 25th anniversary beer in 2 years. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
You still paying attention?
Are you there? Hello, 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 hello. I'm talking to you. Hi. Hey, this is Jack Inslee. I'm the executive producer here at Heritage Radio Network. I've been here at the station since 2009, and I cannot believe just how much this network has grown over that time. We've been able to grow because of donations from people like you. So if you're enjoying this, if you laughed, if you learned something, contribute anything. $1, $2, $10, $100, $1,000, anything counts. And trust me, we'll appreciate seeing your name come through on the donations. So consider visiting heritageradionetwork.org, click on that little beating heart, the donate button, and show us you care. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Jack, that was an awesome little intro. We do love the network, heritageradionetwork.org. Become a member. I'm a member. I think I've been member 501 for 5 years, so I'm really into it. Are you a member at a Heritage Radio Network?
Not yet.
You should be.
Well, not now. I lost my seat.
But we had a good question. A good question was, in 2 years, Mugs Ale House in Williamsburg has its 25th anniversary. Which local breweries now would you talk to about doing a special 25th anniversary brew? And you know, what style would that be? That's a good one.
Well, you know,
maybe Steven can make a style for you guys.
We actually had a 20th that we approached Brooklyn Brewery with, and they did a phenomenal job. It was called Blood Brothers IPA. It was a red IPA at about 8.5%. And they did a great job because they were there from the beginning when we were there from the beginning. So we kind of felt that was appropriate. Now at 25, so many more breweries. I mean, you know, I'd have to hit the other half. I'd have to hit single cut. I'd like to get a little, you know, group going of a whole bunch of brewers. And actually, it would be a nice little, I guess, tip of the hat to me, I guess.
Jeff's book, because he talks about a lot of styles. Steven and Jeff, what would be good styles for a 25th anniversary beer?
I would think you should only approach brewers that are younger than 25. Ah. I think you can probably find quite a few now in New York City.
That's not a bad idea. I like that. Well, I mean, I but then the whole thing is I have to like, it becomes difficult because, you know, Barrier, they started later. I mean, they started earlier than the other guys, but we've been pouring them for a while. So if I kind of, now people will get offended. So I shouldn't mention anything. Forget about it. Scratch it all. We're not going to. I'm going to get New Jersey brewers.
Let's go. Historically, in your book, The Beer Bible, what would be a good style that would work as a 25th anniversary beer?
Well, you know, I one thing that I learned when I went to Europe and I came back and saw American brewing is when you travel around Europe, every single country brews differently. We talked a little bit about Belgium, and with DuPont, they do the warm room thing where they do secondary fermentation. That's totally typical. All beers in Belgium do that. In the Czech Republic, they use decoction mash for every beer. In order to actually be called Czech beer, České pivo, it's got to be decocted. We talked about mild ale in England. They do cask ale in England. Everybody does their own thing. But basically, we haven't had a new beer style emerge since probably the Czechs did Pilsner. I mean, a national tradition, it hasn't really emerged in 150 years, except maybe the United States. So the United States now brews these crazy hoppy IPAs. And one of the things that makes them so interesting and different from the English IPAs is we focused on flavor and aroma hops, not only American hops, which are also distinctive, but those really rich flavors and aromas that come when you add the hops later in the brewing process.
Right.
And they're copying this. When you go to England now, when you go to London, everybody's making American IPAs. When I went to Prague, American IPAs. They were like, said, you want an IPA? You want an IPA? And I was like, what are you talking? And they showed me the point of the board. Oh, IPA. I see what you're talking about. So that's the thing now. So I would say, 25th anniversary, that coincides with America? No?
I want open fermented. I want Brooklyn air in it. I IPAs, I'm a hophead. So I'm right up there with you with that. But
right, we're America, man.
I know we are.
And Americans love that stuff.
Oh, I love it.
Our listeners right now, they're thinking, make an IPA. That's what they're thinking. They're making an IPA.
You know what it is, though? It's like, I really, for 25 years, I'd tell you, I'd want an Imperial Stout. Because it's something that I could have sit there. Because like our blood brothers, we held on to Sixtals for about 2-3 years. And, as any IPA, after a couple of years, you can't age IPAs. So I wouldn't mind having something where I can have a little life on it on the long run.
Well, you could ask people, bring me your 25-year-old beers.
Or maybe somebody will do like an Imperial Stout blended with IPA, and then we'll figure like some other crazy stuff.
Let's go back. We first had this Austrian Trappist beer, the Engazel. It's a 9.5% Trappist ale.
Right. Go.
Style.
Yeah. So this is the interesting thing. There is no style. Abbey ales are their own style. And actually, one of the most interesting things is, if you look at Belgium, since they're mainly brewed in Belgium, they reflect the region that they were brewed in. So when you look at West Vleteren and St. Bernardus, which used to be a contract brew for West Vleteren, they make these really dark...
Number 12.
Yeah, the number 12s. So that's like a classic Flanders style. They make big, heavy... dark ales. Yep. You look at Westmalle, that's where the strong pale ale emerged, and actually the triple style started at Westmalle, so that's like a classic thing. You look at Orval, and those are like, that's where they made the Saison. So Orval is basically a Saison. It's like totally different from all the other
Have
ones.
We broken those styles out here in the States? Like taken the Trappist beers and said, this is a Belgian strong ale, or this is a Belgian pale ale. Have we interpreted that differently, or is that, or I mean, like, because you said that Trappist is its own style, right? Or Abbey is its own style, you said.
It's sort of its own. It's a category, but it has all these umbrella. different beers that are kind of...
But there, they don't interpret it that way, though.
Yeah, for them...
It's a good point. So it's by country, by region, there's different.
Well, because we do a Belgian festival in December, and it's always like, we'll get some of these crazy Belgian beers, and it's like,
I was going to say the same thing. And mine's December 5th, Battle of the Belgians, we showcase this. When's
I'm older
this
than you.
When's yours?
This first weekend of December.
It's probably the same.
You're never going to let it go.
December 5th.
You're never going to let it
Belgian
go.
Belgian weekend in New York City. Mugs Ale House.
Exactly.
And
we should join forces.
Yeah.
You should join forces.
And Stephen, have you made a recipe with Abbey Ale style?
Oh yeah, I mean it's really some of our favorite beers. We used to make a kit for making a triple, but we just couldn't fit it in the box anymore because it was 10%.
Right.
So you have to make compromises.
We have Allagash makes a triple. A lot of people make that's why we started doing Battle of the Belgians, because a lot of American breweries are making great Belgians, and Omegang has their Abbey Ale.
I like to tell people you should try Westmalle Triple. If you haven't had that beer before and you're an American fan, you think that the Belgians are not so good. That's 38 IBUs, and it's such a strong beer. It's so thin that those hops really pop. And it actually, there's a way in which you can look at the Westmalle Triple and kind of see triple IPA or double IPA in it.
I've always thought Belgian beers are most interesting. I mean, we're catching up now, but I mean, in the early days, they were the most interesting and the most, like, they had a lot going for them. And I hate seeing them, like, being pushed back, but you know.
And I think a lot of people, I think, are going to start discovering. And it's fine. Some consultants have said, "Oh, if you're going to open a brewery now, you have to either do English style, German style, or Belgian style, because they feel like that you have to have some identity." But that's another point. But
it's like Belgian beers being brewed in Italy.
But Steven, right. So you just opened a beer for us, and we're talking about IPAs. What's the black IPA that you made?
Yeah, black IPA. This is one of our new test batches. We're always brewing different beers to figure out what to make next.
One of the toughest styles to sell at Mugs.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that style.
Two or three years ago, were these popular?
I'm noticing that
black IPAs.
Yeah,
they've been around, and I think they're great. But it's to put them up on a draft line. It's people aren't attracted to them. They just, I don't know if it's the color or what. They just don't.
But Steve,
they're not appealing.
What were you saying? Something happened to that.
Oh, sorry.
No.
I'm just noticing that. Like one thing I noticed about the book is that it is, if for anyone who doesn't have it in front of them like we do, it's laid out by style, which I think is a great way to introduce people to beer that maybe they know something they don't know too much, or they just want to learn, really dig into a particular style. So then we have black IPAs or Cascadian dark ales, and beer changing so much. So how do you write a book that is like literally is the beer Bible, and how do you stay on top of these changing styles like black IPA or Cascadian dark ale?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the styles that we're seeing brewed in America, and America is by far the most innovative. We're really doing a lot of new stuff. But it refers back to traditional style. So the black IPA is like, what happens if we put some roasted malt in an IPA? Like, how can we get a quality that is dark and hoppy at the same time? So what I did in the book is I had a little section in each thing that talked about the evolution and where the style is headed. And I tried to talk about what I've seen out there, you know, where breweries are taking these styles. And sometimes they're not taking them anywhere. Some styles like the mild ale, that's not going anywhere. That's like frozen in amber. But some styles, IPAs, are totally, people are doing session IPAs, white IPAs, Belgian IPAs, black IPAs, everything. So, you know, we're seeing all the stuff. And I did try to mention
wheat IPAs.
And, but talking about the black IPA, though, a few years ago, I felt like they were really hot. And then that's what Ed's saying. Then they're not moving.
I haven't had it. I mean, you know what? The only one is the one we have up now is the other half's black IPA. I
think the Doug.
Doug, right.
Yeah.
That's the only one that's really been, like, moving along. I don't know if it's the evolution of people and saying, all right, well, now it's something that we like, or if it's other half. I don't know. But it's the only one that we kind of really are getting through.
And, it seems like a winter IPA to me. If I were at a pub, I'd put my black IPAs on in January.
The first time we put a Hefeweizen up on draft, and that was Oberdorfer. We put it up in December, and we sold the hell out of it. So I'm not looking at seasons.
I don't know.
But
what
I will say
about.
That I liked black IPA, and when I think when it's called Cascadian Dark Ale, I don't think that's.
Maybe
very
that's
appealing.
What it is. They got to change the name and make it officially.
Why couldn't they just call it Black IPA? Why do they have to make it a whole other name?
Well, so that comes from my region, this Cascadian Dark Ale, and it's because there's some folks there who are agitating that the style started there and it had distinctive characteristics that are so. Cascadia is this region from Northern California up through Southern British Columbia. Basically. My region is incredibly parochial, and we want everything to be referential to us. And there's no difference between CDA and black IPA. I'm going to say it here, and they're going to burn me at the stake when I get home.
It's amazing that,
really
there's
basically the deal.
That there's a TV show about Portland, Oregon.
They're going to send you back to New York.
We love that show, too. We love that show, and we're happy to have people make fun of us, which is why they probably won't totally burn me at the stake, but I'll probably take a little crap for this.
Anyways, we had a good conversation. We drank a lot of beers. I will say next week, on Tuesday, Travel Portland's bringing three Portland, Oregon brewers to New York City. Guys from the Commons, Occidental, and Gigantic.
Wow.
And they'll be at a fancy thing at the Nomad Tuesday. Wednesday night, though, you get your bargain deal, go to Jimmy's Number 43, and you can just buy their beer. We're going to have nine taps of all
nice.
Portland, Oregon beers. Yeah.
Say hi to those guys.
It's our 10th anniversary.
I'm coming.
Yeah, man. That's going to be that's probably the coolest night of my life.
Yeah,
definitely.
But it's so cool to have you here, you know, previewing your book, Beer Bible. Steven, you want to weigh in on anything else before we close out?
I'm just going to sit here and read this book.
It's pretty good, man. And Ed, thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how you pulled that one off, but all right.
Well, and let's put it this way. December 5th comes, you can go to Mug's Ale House in Waynesburg for your Belgian
Brooklyn
night.
Yes.
And
yes.
Jamie's number 43 for Battle of the
Bells. We're doing the weekend.
All right. But it's good to have you guys on, and really thanks for coming out, Jeff. I really like your book. I'm probably at about page 50.
I got to get a copy.
I fibbed it tonight, but
no,
I'm going to read the whole thing.
It's very long. I'm sorry. But it's good reading for years to come.
It's a lot to bear.
So thanks, everybody, to Jeff, Ed, and Steven for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. I'm Jimmy Carbone. Thanks to our producers, Justin Kennedy and Maggie Seiden. And thanks to our engineer, Jack Inslee. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.